from the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing. This is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the August 2015 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Royal Patron. His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent has officially opened the Road to Bletchley Park, a major new exhibition looking at the roots of codebreaking in World War I. We'll hear some of the best bits from the last 3 years of the veterans' reunions. As this year's approaches, it's always a highlight of the year for veterans and their families, making new memories as they revisit their wartime workplace and learn more about the things they weren't allowed to know at the time. We'll find out who's still to come in the Bletchley Park Presents lecture series, and we'll tell you all about what we've got going on for kids during the school holidays at no extra cost. But first, Sinclair Mackay has written numerous books about Bletchley Park. It all began with The Secret Life of Bletchley Park, which tells the stories of a wide array of veterans. He's described writing about the Government Code and Cipher School as the best job of his life. Sinclair's most recent book is about RAF Fighter Command, which was scattered at air bases the length and breadth of Britain to thwart Nazi attacks and save the country from invasion. In his book, The Secret Life of Fighter Command, he tells the stories of the men and women in this unique and world-famous organisation. He gave a talk on the subject as part of the Bletchley Park Presents lecture series, and I caught up with him afterwards to reflect on what draws him to the secret side of World War II again and again. So, the simplest of all questions, tell me what Fighter Command was.
Fighter Command was the defensive arm of the Royal Air Force. In a sense, it was there to defend Great Britain during the war. In contrast to, say, Bomber Command, which was there to take the war out to Germany, Fighter Command, certainly in its early incarnations, was there as a defensive web around the British Isles.
It was pioneering new technology.
Yes, not only pioneering, but also at the time top secret. It was Watson Watt and his discovery of radar, which came about as a matter of pure serendipity. In the early 1930s, Whitehall had asked scientists to look into the possibility of creating a death ray, because there had been rumours that the Germans had created a death ray. And it was obviously there in popular fiction too. I think in the novels of William Le Queux in the 1910s and the 1920s, there was putative death rays. So the boffins went out there and thought, well, can we create a device that would basically sort of kill a sheep in a field? And they started experimenting. They didn't manage to kill any sheep in fields. But what they discovered, incidentally, as a result of their research into death rays, was radar. Which is infinitely more useful, rather more benevolent technology, and obviously it's a complete lifesaver when it came to constructing this defence of Britain, because Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister, famously said back in the 1930s, the bomber will always get through, and that was the abiding fear. At a time of great technological development, aeroplanes were getting much more sophisticated, bombers were getting much more sophisticated. What could stop a bomber? Well, Lord Dowding in Fighter Command managed to put together an answer. If you could surround the British Isles with radar that could detect the incoming bombers, plus also fill Fighter Command with brilliant people who could do some trigonometry in their heads, and then radio out instructions to the pilots and the aerodromes, then they could target their response rather than having to patrol the skies the whole time, run out of fuel, run out of fighters, run out of pilots. Strategically, it was absolutely brilliant.
It's the sort of thing that we absolutely take for granted. You can't imagine warfare without radar.
No.
You can't even imagine civil aviation without radar now, can you?
No, indeed not.
So it was absolutely at the white heat cutting edge, wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And the funny thing about Fighter Command was that it developed roughly at the same time when Bletchley Park was really starting to kind of pull together as well. It's generally said about the war that Britain was kind of unprepared in a general sense, that it wasn't quite ready. But actually, as we've seen with Government Code and Cipher School, they were well on the case, very much so throughout the 1930s. So too were Fighter Command. It was 1936, I think, they moved into Bentley Priory, this lovely 18th century house on the fringes of London, started excavating this secret underground chamber, which would contain the latest in high-tech equipment, and it was known as the Hole, where all these women and men worked. And so the pleasing parallels between Bletchley Park and Bentley Priory, also this thing of anyone working there having to sign the Official Secrets Act and not saying a word to anyone about what they were doing.
How did the story of Fighter Command start to come out then? Because we know here at Bletchley Park it was 30 years after the end of the war, more or less, and one book began the trickle. So what happened with Fighter Command?
It came out much quicker, but oddly enough, there hasn't been so much focus on Fighter Command itself, because the focus with the Battle of Britain has been more on the aerodromes and the pilots themselves, understandably enough, because
they're
feats,
the derring do,
the unimaginable courage and the unimaginable bravery. But what you see now in the RAF archives, the National Archives, is a kind of satisfyingly rich portrait, not only of all those pilots, but also the guiding forces behind them too. What life was like at Bentley Priory and the various Fighter Command operations as they spread throughout the country and the work that they did, which has not received as much celebration perhaps as it could have done.
Well, maybe it will now. You talked about Douglas Bader. Tell me about how this impacted on him and how he comes into the story.
Almost immediately after the war, his biography is written by Paul Brickhill. There was a film made about him, starring Kenneth Moore. And Douglas Bader, in many ways, was the face of the RAF Fighter Command, simply because, talk about indefatigable, having lost both his legs, having been through an unbelievably painful reconstruction process with these basically tin legs, early prosthetic legs, having to learn how to walk again, having to learn basically how to live again. And this extraordinarily kind of fierce, determined man, also determined to fly again. Flying was his absolute first love, and nothing would stop him. So the RAF in the interwar years said, no, you can't come back in. It's not practical. Look at your legs. Come the war, he was allowed back in, and thank goodness too. A kind of terrific figure, not just because of his flying feats, but also because he was kind of newspaper copy too. Just the mere mention of his name seemed to inspire confidence. If you look back through those newspapers now, in 1939, 1940, you see his name crop up, and he's a familiar name even then.
He's propaganda poster boy.
Indeed so, and the RAF in the Fighter Command was very, very important for that, and Douglas Bader was very important for that too. Unusually, among RAF pilots, he was more or less teetotal. In fact, I think it's a totally teetotal. But what really, really sings through is his kind of passion for flying. That, together with a very, very funny, belligerent sense of humour. He was shot down by the Germans in 1940. He got away parachute. I think one of his prosthetic legs became detached, and his German captors found it for him. And at the very beginning, when he was a German prisoner of war, there were an awful lot of Luftwaffe pilots, rather aristocratic Luftwaffe pilots, who wanted to come and meet him because he was Douglas Bader. How could they not want to meet him? They wanted to talk, not war, they wanted to talk about some planes and specifications and flying. And so there was still that curious sense of a brotherhood of pilots, which he very much embodied. Mind you, as a prisoner of war, he caused an enormous amount of trouble. So much so that the authorities said, we're going to take away your legs if you don't stop it.
It was an underground bunker at an old country house. It was filled with, would you say, a strange collection of characters? Some quite sort of eccentric characters?
Possibly not quite as gibberingly eccentric as some of the Bletchley Park characters. There are no kind of Dilly Noxons, for instance, cramming sandwiches into pipes and standing up naked in baths while going through codes in his head. But at the same time, Bentley Priory, what you did get was a... Certainly what I had, like, Bletchley Park was this fantastically youthful atmosphere, in the sense that a lot of young women working there, very bright young women who were very, very determined to get into that side of the war, still in their teens. As I said, there were people like Gladys Ever, who is still very much with us today, still fizzing with vitality. A South London girl, she said she put the toot into tooting.
Yeah.
And they did have this extraordinary life. In the midst of this unbelievable national crisis, the Battle of Britain going on above their heads, day after day, night after night, they still found time for laughter.
Well, there must have been a need, especially with them being so young and fizzing with vitality as they were, and knowing that they were doing something so important, there must have been a sense of blowing off steam, of actually the, it being the flip side of that focus and that adrenaline, especially because what they were doing, more so than if we're, you know, comparing, we can't help but because you're here giving this talk, comparing it with Bletchley Park, it was perhaps much more in real time played out as the battles were played out.
I think possibly it was more satisfying in Bentley Priory because they could see directly the results.
Here at Bletchley Park, it might have felt a bit more backrooms.
A bit more abstract at Bletchley Park because you wouldn't always know the exact provenance of what it was that you were working on or what it is that you would help crack or what the card reference was to do with what particular aspect of the war. There were so many different aspects. Whereas Bentley Priory, Fighter Command, in this underground chamber, it was all in front of you, second by second, minute by minute. And it was your instance of trigonometry, your instant mathematical calculations that was plotting these incoming bombers. And just half an inch out, either way, could be the difference between life and death. And these young women knew it. And when they left their shifts at midnight and went up to ground level to the gardens of Bentley Priory, they would see the orange glow of the Blitz 15 miles in the distance, London ablaze. So yes, they could see directly what it was that they were doing. But they managed somehow to have a very good time. Eileen Younghusband told me a lovely story about how there was a particular house which was used as a kind of mess house. They all relaxed there. But there was a tradition where any new young woman came in, she would have to dip her bare feet in cold ash, and then she would be held up by an RAF officer, and she would have to print her feet on the ceiling. There would have to be her footprints on the ceiling. Every young woman who worked at Bedley Priory had to go through that initiation.
So down, thinking, what will my father say? What is there to see now, and what kind of state is it in?
It's in a fantastic state now, because just as Bletchley Park has been restored and renewed so kind of hearteningly and so brilliantly for visitors of all ages, with fantastic imagination and imaginative space, they've done something very similar at Bentley Priory. If you go there now, it started opening up more or less full-time as a museum, and they've restored it so that they've rebuilt an operations and a filters room. They're not underground this time, they're part of the house, because it would be too much, I think, to go down there. But the house itself is an 18th century, rather beautiful construction in its own right. And throughout the house, they've got all sorts of Battle of Britain memorabilia. They've got interactive displays involving a rather spooky Lord Dowding display, where they project him in three dimensions in his office, and doors open and close and all the rest of it. And you get special telephones issuing orders. There's all sorts of stuff to go there, and for all ages. And so it's a museum, I think, dedicated largely to the Battle of Britain, the memory of the Battle of Britain. So particularly on the 75th anniversary, it's well worth a visit.
Well, thank you for a fascinating talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much for asking me.
Still to come in the Bletchley Park Presents lecture series, Tessa Dunlop will be here on the 20th of September to talk about the fascinating and diverse women featured in her book, The Bletchley Girls. They include Lady Jean Ford, who worked with Alan Turing, Morse listener Betty Gilbert, and German-speaking Pat Davies, who were sent to remote outposts known as Y stations, where they listened in to the enemy's coded communications. Women outnumbered men at Bletchley Park by around 2-1. Tessa delves into some of their fascinating life stories. Don't despair of your children being off school for another 3 weeks or so yet. Bring them to Bletchley Park, where there's a rolling programme of daily changing activities laid on at no extra cost. Bright Sparks at Bletchley Park entices kids of all ages to learn about code breaking, World War II and e-safety, without even realising it's doing them good because they're so busy having fun. There are spy workshops, a secret room, trails, quizzes and historical artefacts they're allowed to touch. See the What's On section of the website for details. Bletchley Park has once again welcomed a member of the royal family to help launch a major new exhibition. On the 29th of July, Bletchley Park's royal patron, His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent, launched The Road to Bletchley Park, the first phase of a two-part exhibition about codebreaking during World War I, and how it laid the foundations for the successes of the Government Code and Cipher School some 20 years later. The second phase of this exhibition is due to open in 2017. The Duke met the design team and the sponsors behind the exhibition, BAE Systems and Ultra Electronics, before announcing it officially open. He was also given a grand tour of Bletchley Park to see all the restoration and interpretation that's been done since his last visit in 2009.
I understand Major Malcolm Hay will be taking over as head of department. Anyone for a cup of tea?
Another year over and still this wretched war staggers on. When dealing with visitors from neutral countries, I have a policy. It is advisable to confuse them. Therefore, on my staff, I have a man who gives the impression of a typical British idiot. I disappear, and the other man stands in for me as my trusted assistant, creating the impression that there is nothing to fear from the intellect of MI1B.
So it's another July, and another royal visit. You must be penciling these in your calendar every year now, Steve.
You could say that, yeah. Might not be next July for the next one.
Yeah, I think Overlord may be a few years in the future, I think. So you're probably safe for next summer. So you've just met the Duke of Kent, and what did he think of it?
He obviously was engaged. He was thoroughly interested in it, and he did ask the unanswerable question. Who was the first person to actually think of breaking into a radio message?
And we don't know, do we?
No.
We may have to ask our friendly GCHQ historian that before the day's out.
Yeah, well, they're here, let's ask them. They probably do know who's the first. But, I mean, I think it's one of those impossible questions, really.
Obviously, you were behind Operation Neptune, the restoration of Bletchley Park, and we featured you during the restoration, and a year ago when we finally got to open it all. This must have been a completely different set of challenges for you to bring the First World War alive. Because, obviously, again, there's even less for you to work with, isn't there?
Yes, there is the challenge that there's less information to work with. There is also the challenge that it's still situated within Bletchley Park. And the whole thing actually happened before Bletchley Park became Bletchley Park. And therefore, one of the biggest challenges as designers that we had was to actually come up with something that would sit within this space, would be able to evoke another era and another place. And I think that is as much of a challenge as anything else, because that other era is very different from everything that's been set up in the rest of Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park has a very strong presence. And that presence has been emphasised by the architectural work, especially in this building. Therefore, to try and create something that's different was a... overusing the word challenge, aren't we?
No, it
was another challenge.
You said to us last year that the whole thing about museum design is people don't realise it's about storytelling, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the core for you, isn't it?
Storytelling is the core. The narrative is the primary source. It's where everything starts from. If there isn't this story, if there isn't the narrative, then you've got nothing. You've got an empty shell, which will never work. Fortunately, here was some amazing stories. There's some eccentricity, which I think goes with the time. And hopefully we've managed to capture that eccentricity.
Oh, I think you have, easily. I mean, a story about Dilly Knox sitting in the bath thinking has manifested itself into a bath in the middle of an exhibition. You wouldn't expect to see that, but the way it's been done with the audio as well, I think it's remarkable.
Yeah, good. Again, it becomes one of those things that becomes a way of engaging people. It becomes a memory moment, the fact that they can walk into an exhibition and there's a bathtub sat in the middle of it. I had in mind, right from the start, that famous piece of theatre and actually a film, Oh, What a Lovely War.
Oh, yeah.
Which evoked the First World War in a special kind of way. I think it captured that sense of eccentricity. So therefore, the introductory film set in, we hope, something that looks a bit like a theatre. The bathtub, obviously, just fits right in. But the way that we dealt with the stories of the army intelligence, the problem of how do you film personalities that are long dead and you don't necessarily have an image of what they looked like, nor what they sounded like. So we had to use just arms. We thought by just using arms and filming people sat round a desk but cutting the body off and just using the arms was a great way of getting around the problem of what did they look like.
I've never seen that before. That desktop scene is really unique, I think. You say about Oh, What a Lovely War, it suddenly all becomes obvious now. It does really evoke that. Like you say, the eccentricity of it all, you know, Alice in Wonderland and things like that. It is all sort of intertwined into these code breakers from World War One, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. There again, you know, what a gem to get hold of, the Alice in Wonderland story. The fact that they imagined themselves as the Manhattan or the Sleeping Dormouse.
Yeah.
Just great. That was lovely. I mean, the other thing about the exhibition is that we're actually only halfway through it.
Yes.
Second phase to come.
How far along are you on the planning stages of that?
The exhibition was concept design as a whole. It wasn't possible to do everything in one phase. It had to be done in two phases. The problem with that as a designer is that you can't design one phase.
No.
You have to design the whole thing. There are details that we haven't got for the phase two yet, but it is planned out. I know exactly what bit's going where.
I suppose it's a bit like picking your favourite child then, isn't it? It's which bit do we put into phase two?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. There is a frustration more than anything else because, as I say, you've got it all planned anyway. It's where to draw the line to make the division. And it's inevitable that what will be, you know, the favourite bit is always going to be in phase two. So it's not happened here. I still like the bathtub as much as anything else. But we're dealing with naval warfare, the Zeppelins, and Y stations, which I think it's quite useful that the Y stations themselves are introduced and will be introduced in this part of the exhibition. And the whole exhibition then will end with a much more detailed display about the Zimmermann telegram,
which was fundamentally important in bringing the United States into the First World War, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think we've got a little trick of our sleeves for that.
Well, we look forward to that, Steve. And time for a rest now, is it?
Time for a rest. On holiday at the moment, so...
And then on to the next phases.
And on to the next phases and at event. There's just so many projects still ongoing.
Brilliant. Well, it's good. Thank you for helping to tell the story, Steve.
Good. Glad you enjoyed it.
Mr. Knox, I know that you're in the bath, but do you need me to take down any codes that you've deciphered during the night?
Miss Rodham, I must speak with Dr. Willoughby at once.
So I'm very lucky now to be sat with another relation of one of our World War One codebreakers. I've got Michael de Grey with me. Now, Michael, who was your relation?
My relation, as far as the First World War is concerned, was Nigel de Grey, my grandfather, a decoder, one of many old Etonians chosen to decode. And so that was what he did. Of course, I didn't know anything about that until 1973, or that just after 1973, I think, when either Mr. Kahn or his representative who wrote the book, The Code Breakers, came to our house and asked us to identify his writing. The bit of paper that he showed us was, as I now know, the Zimmermann telegram, and it was in German, and there were letters written in English above a number of the words and phrases, and my mother and I were asked whether we recognised Nigel de Grey's writing on that paper, and we both said without hesitation, that is his writing. And although there were other people's writing on it as well, it was clear to us that the substance, the main part of it, was in his writing, and that, as is now known, he was the person who was the main decoder, although he was assisted by Montgomery and Knox in this. And this, of course, the Zimmermann telegram, is one of the major factors in the First World War. What the telegram was from the German High Command, Zimmermann, to their ambassador in Mexico, proposing, amongst other things, that the Germans and the Mexicans should get together to attack the United States. The three surrounding states would be their reward. They would be given these when the Americans were defeated. Therefore, the decoding of this message was of extreme importance because America, of course, was not in the war at that time. So my grandfather, having decoded it, obviously took it to higher authority, and it was decided that they would not say anything about having done it and that they would find, and indeed they did, a way of getting that telegram to the Americans without it being in any way apparent that it had come from England. This they did, and of course the Americans were infuriated and horrified, and this is what brought the Americans into the war. And as my grandfather is reputed to have said, and this is entirely hearsay, at a meeting in the office a few days later, once the Americans had joined the war, "Ladies and gentlemen, the toast is America, because now we are going to win the war." That is not written down anywhere. It's a story that has come via various relations. Another interesting thing about Nigel was that at that time he was great friends with one of his relations, really very close friends. And this relation more or less cut him off during the First World War because he couldn't understand why he wasn't wearing uniform, whereas he was going to the war and was in the trenches.
Because that's what so many of our codebreakers at Bletchley Park suffered.
Indeed, that's exactly what would have happened. So Nigel was somewhat mystified by this, I think, but it would appear from family hearsay that they met again in spite of this, indeed, it said that Nigel sought out this relation, and he obviously said something, because in those days there was no Official Secrets Act, but he said enough to this relation for the relation to say, "Ah, I see. It was you who won the war, not me in the trenches."
That's fantastic.
Again, I can't absolutely vouch for it, but it does come from a good family source, that particular story. It's easy for me to say, isn't it? But, I mean, it probably transformed the result of the First World War.
Without a doubt. I think without a doubt, because the spring offensive of 1918 that the Germans launched, I think without the American intervention by
then, yes, I
probably
agree.
Would have broken the French forces.
Yeah, yeah.
But with the Americans there,
the whole thing was different.
Yeah, and we can thank your grandfather for that.
Well, and his colleagues and all the people who did the work, particularly in those early days, it must have been very hard. And I'm delighted that I'm able to, even though I was so young, 8 and a half when he died, I'm able, because we have got certain bits of information within the family, we're able to put it together and bring it to everybody who comes to any exhibition or whatever.
And when you speak about your grandfather, the pride is just so obvious on your face.
Yes, because, I mean, if there's one thing you can say is that my grandfather did something life-saving for our country. What would have happened if they hadn't decoded that telegram?
Well, I'm Douglas Castor. I'm the chairman of Ultra Electronics. The head office of Ultra is based in Greenford, although we're a very widely geographically dispersed organisation with operations in the UK, in the US, in the Middle East, and even in Australia. We're quite a diverse organisation geographically, but we also have a great diversity of activity, lots of specialist capabilities, too many to mention, but most of the big companies, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, British Aerospace, Rolls-Royce, they all come to Ultra to access some of the specialist technology that we have that they don't have, and some of our capabilities to help them with their products.
What first brought Ultra to Bletchley Park? What was the interest in Bletchley Park?
Well, I guess we've had a long-term interest as a company in cryptographic activities. We have an association with GCHQ, work for them, and the UK MOD, and in cybersecurity areas. And so it's a natural place to have an interest in, particularly because of the heritage. It's going back to the roots, it's where it all started. And so Bletchley, looking for sponsorship and fundraising, we're just really trying to do our bit for Bletchley in that way.
Especially with the road to Bletchley Park, because it is a new part of the story that we're trying to tell. Because so many of those people that our listeners have come to learn about from World War II actually started in World War I, and that's the story that we're trying to tell, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, I don't know that many people really understand or are aware of what is the so-called Room 40 activity. And it was really that activity during the First World War that was critical to the naval war, being able to find the ships and the U-boats, and the continuity of that activity in the pre-war years that then gave Bletchley really the flying start to play the part that it did in the Second World War.
That, in a way, is where Ultra come into the story, because there is a direct connection then into the Second World War, isn't there, with products that Ultra originally used to make?
Yes, in those days we didn't do any of the cryptographic activity, but Ultra was one of the early exploiters and providers of technology that was used in the submarine war, that we are the world's leading supplier of things called sonobuoys. And these are devices which are launched from aircraft. They're air launch sensors, which divide into two parts. A listening device, generally an acoustic listening device, deploys down to the depth in the sea. And the other part rises to the surface on a float, which deploys an antenna, an aerial. And so the information from the acoustic sensor is relayed to the surface unit. And from there, it's transmitted through a radio signal up into the aircraft, where those signals can be analysed. And from that, you can determine the position and the location of the submarine.
Slightly more advanced than they probably were in World War II, I've no doubt. But same general principle.
Same principles, really. As you say, much more advanced. If you look at it, we take advantage now of much more modern technology, particularly digital signal processing,
submarines have got much quieter these days, and they're an ever-present threat. You know, there are something like 500 capable submarines around the world, quite a lot of them in the hands of people that we might not think are particularly friendly.
So for you personally, is it something to feel proud of that you're helping to tell the story of early days of code-breaking and to help Bletchley Park?
Of course it is. I mean, who wouldn't be proud of the story of Bletchley and the part that it played? But I think explaining the role of the early days, because I think that was an important precursor to the World War II Bletchley story. But I think it's also, for people that come through this exhibition, it's important because it brings it right up to date. You know that everybody is aware of cyber security, and it's making people aware that there's an ongoing issue here, that surveillance for today is as important. And I think that's part of the Bletchley story, that you can see what's going on in terms of how Bletchley protected us in the days of the Second World War, and indeed prior to that, Room 40 in the First World War. But it's the code breakers today, GCHQ and the likes of Ultra Electronics and other companies around the world, that are providing the cryptographic equipment to keep us safe in the web today. This is not just a historic story, a telling of history. It's absolutely relevant today. And I think, again, being part of that is something that Ultra Electronics is proud of.
So here we are with our friendly GCHQ historian in the office where the special relationship was formed, really. There's a reason we're in Commander Denniston's office, and there's a link to why you're here today, isn't there?
There is. We're here today to celebrate the opening of the First World War exhibition. But of course, the people who were in SIGINT during the First World War were the people who led the Code and Cipher School between the wars and who set up the organisation at Bletchley Park in August 1939. There hadn't been any SIGINT before the First World War at all. In fact, it was the explosion of signals that the German Army and German Navy started sending at the beginning of August 1914 that first awoke people to the possibility that there might be intelligence potential in all of these messages. In both the War Office and the Admiralty, cryptanalytic sections were set up. And after the Russians had captured a copy of the German High Sea Fleet codebook from the Magdeburg, a German cruiser which went aground on the 26th of August 1914, a copy of the codebook was sent to the Admiralty, and in November 1914 they first began to produce the decrypted messages, which so appealed to the First Lord of the Admiralty, who was Winston Churchill, and it began an interest in signals intelligence for Churchill that lasted for the rest of his life.
You might actually be the only person who could answer a question that the Duke stumped Steve Lumley with, which was, who first came up with the idea of intercepting radio messages?
From the time the Royal Navy began to adopt Marconi's new wireless technology, one of their interests was to see how this technology could be developed. And in the first decade of the 20th century, there are quite a few references to Royal Navy radio technicians listening to the signals coming from foreign navies, not with an interest in the content of the messages, but just seeing how other people were using this new technology to send signals farther and louder. They actually thought that the content of the messages was of no interest, and that leads us actually down a completely separate rabbit hole. The reason they thought like that was because most naval messages in peacetime were short and administrative. It took a war for there to be operational messages that were worth producing intelligence from.
Obviously, by the time we get to World War II, we've got one organisation, the Government Code and Cipher School. But it wasn't that way during World War I, was it? Or leading up to World War I? Why was that?
Partly it's because, as I've said, nobody had predicted that there'd be intelligence available from intercepted communications. Partially, too, because the Admiralty and the War Office both worked in very different ways. And though the cryptanalysts worked together for the first few months of the war, the separate interest that each had in producing intelligence relating to their own services meant that there was little room for cooperation. At the end of the First World War, when the senior politicians, Lord Curzon, Winston Churchill, Lloyd George, wanted to see a signals intelligence organisation that would keep going in peacetime, it was abundantly clear that given that there was no war and that diplomatic interception would be far more important, that there should just be a single organisation. And while the Foreign Office and the Admiralty fought over who would be in control of the organisation, it was in the Admiralty from 1919 to 1923 and then moved to the Foreign Office, nobody actually questioned the need to have a single organisation instead of two.
It was obvious by then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
By the time the war ended, MI1B employed just under 90 people. Britain had become a world leader in the field of intelligence. In 1919, Alistair Denniston, a Room 40 linguist and codebreaker, headed a carefully selected group of Room 40 and MI1B employees, forming the new Government Code and Cipher School, which continued to ply its trade through the 1920s and 30s, before Denniston brought his team here to Bletchley Park at the advent of the Second World War.
Well, I'm very, very lucky because I'm sitting in a very important chair at the moment and I'm being looked at by two ladies who have a very important relation who used to sit in a chair in this office. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Candy Connolly. I'm Robin Denniston's daughter, that is A.G. Denniston's granddaughter.
And I'm Judith Finch. And my mother was A.G. Denniston's daughter, so he's my grandfather as well.
And I think I wouldn't be going too far to say how proud both you ladies are of your grandfather, are you?
Very proud and amazingly fortunate to be sitting in this office of his, as it was in a way in 1939 when they first came here. So it's an amazing office.
We're here today for the official opening of the road to Bletchley Park. There's that direct link with your grandfather to here, to this office, and that started in Room 40, didn't it?
Most definitely. My grandfather was called up to Room 14 in August. He was there August the 3rd of 1914 when the First World War was declared. Then they had no idea of what to do with these new radio waves, bringing messages that they had never dealt with before, and they were working out what to do with them. So right from the beginning, he was in Room 40. And he saw the mistakes that were made in Room 40 as well as the amazing discoveries. I think Room 40 itself was a kind of a real learning chamber of how to deal with this information. And he was at the heart of all the activity. I know that my grandfather was at Versailles, indeed with his wife, although I'm not sure that they were married at that stage. Anyway, he met his wife, incidentally, in Room 40, but they were both at Versailles. And at Versailles, there was a feeling that there should be now no more listening on other people's private conversations. But being a linguist, he could hear that the Germans were not happy and that it would be very important to keep listening. So that then, in 1919, Churchill did say that there should be a small group, you know, no funds for it, but that there should be a listening opportunity kept going. And they had to decide who was to be leading this small group, because obviously, as we've seen from the exhibition, there was the military listening and the naval listening. So they interviewed Major Hay from the military, and they said to Major Hay, what would you feel if you were deputy to AGD, or indeed if you had AGD as your deputy? To which he very strongly responded, AGD has nothing to teach me. I don't need him, and I wouldn't need to work with him. Then A.G. Denniston was interviewed and was asked, what would you feel if you were deputy to Major Hay, or he deputy to you? How would you feel that would work? And he said, whatever will serve the country best, I would work with him to make the United information more valuable. And after that, he was given the job.
I think the nice thing about this new exhibition is it gives people, maybe for the first time, a glimpse into the commander's background. And it's the start, hopefully, of people learning more and more about what he actually did, not just here during the war, which is fundamentally important, but prior to that, we've got a new biography being written about him currently, haven't we?
We have a new biography. A very lucky Joel Greenberg, who did the superb biography of Gordon Welshman, has undertaken to do a biography for my grandfather. The interesting thing is that although he'd done this really important work in the First World War, between the wars, in the Second World War, when he died in 1961, there was not one mention of him in any paper. So it was like his name was sort of pushed under the carpet. And that is curious. there will be reasons why that we will learn, I'm sure, as things are more unfolded. But when you see Bletchley Park becoming so strong now in our modern history and in modern life, and we make the connections through Bletchley of the history of the code breaking, now brings us the technology that we use every day. That connection is amazing. And so in time, I'm sure AGD will find his place.
I think he's well overdue, isn't he?
I think he is well overdue. And I think Bletchley Park have done a fantastic job with putting the office that we're sitting in now back to how it was, and making sure that when people come to visit the part that he actually played. And also now with having the Road to Bletchley Park exhibition as well, that really focuses again on the work that happened in Room 40 and how that led up to the work that happened in Bletchley Park. And also then with the book that Joel's writing, hopefully that will then put the end part of the story, because obviously he went on to have a diplomatic career after Bletchley Park.
My father wrote a book, it's called The 30 Secret Years, because his father had done so much, which Dad told me about, but I could never remember it. So I did say to him, please, Dad, please write it down, because I will never remember these things. You know, for example, my grandfather was a translator for Admiral Beattie at the Scarpa Flow. So at the surrender of World War One, he was the person actually writing down the words. And these things I knew I would not remember if Dad didn't write it down for me. But in the preface to that, he talks about Libby, who was AGD's goddaughter and indeed also his niece. So AGD had a sister who he was very, very fond of, and Libby is the daughter of that sister. And he used to look after her when she came to her boarding school. And this was in 1936 to 38. He made time to walk with her across London from one station to another. So he had this very caring side, especially for young ones. And I think he also had a great sense of humour. He used to say that getting Libby past an ice cream van was like getting a dog past a lamppost. So he was a lovely chap.
Years after its secret work concluded, veterans of Bletchley Park and its outstations will gather at this unassuming Buckinghamshire estate on Sunday the 6th of September to remember how they helped to shorten the war. Every September, the Bletchley Park Trust invites veterans and their families back for the reunion, giving visitors a rare opportunity to walk among them and perhaps meet the men and women whose work helped save countless lives. Last year's reunion was busier than ever, with many veterans and their families attending to see the site newly returned to its World War II atmosphere and appearance, with restored landscaping, code-breaking huts, and the vibrant Block C Visitor Centre. What was noticeable at last year's reunion was how the baton of remembrance and celebration of what was achieved here is increasingly being passed down the generations to the veterans' families. In the 3 years the Bletchley Park podcast has been capturing what's happening here, the Veterans Reunion has always been a jewel in the crown of the calendar, creating truly memorable moments.
Take a couple more, so your best smiles. Okay, 3, 2, 1. Perfect, thank you very much indeed for all your hard work. Thank you, everybody else.
My name's Caroline Johnson, and I've come to Bletchley Park because my grandfather worked here during the Second World War. He worked here from 1941 to about 1946, early 46, I believe. And he was head of the Cypher office and deputy head of the Communication Centre. So he had, as far as I'm aware, quite an important role. My grandfather, Sydney White, was clerk in charge of Barclays Bank in Bletchley. And Sir Edward Travis, the director in charge at Bletchley Park, he used to bank at Barclays, so he knew my grandfather. And one day he went in, My grandfather said, I'm sorry, you will have to go to the branch in Fenny Stratford because I've got to close this branch because I've been called up. Sir Edward Travis said, oh, would you like to come and work for me instead? And he started off with 9 employees. At the end, there were about 450 employees, and the communications section had grown from this small unit in Hut 14 to this massive machine in Block E. But I'm sort of putting 2 and 2 together and trying to make 4 from the little information I've so far gained to build a story of my grandfather and what he did.
It's to do with the work that Bill Tutt did. That's how he broke the Lorenz, was on squared paper.
Yeah, but that was before Colossus, wasn't it?
It was before Colossus.
Obviously, if you did something which you then had to take to the lady at the end of the room.
Yeah, you know, if something clicked, I don't know, I can't remember.
Yeah,
there was a leading wren.
It was part of the process.
Yes, at the end, and they kept it. I've often thought, what was I doing afterwards?
It might sort of, you know, spark some memories.
Yes, yes. Well, they had to give me something to do to keep me off the streets.
Of course they did.
Of course, you could have been doing noughts and crosses, of course.
Exactly what I said. I could have been, quite easily. Anyway, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for today, and thank you for the magazines, which are much appreciated.
I wanted to say what may be the last word from the veterans, today anyway. How blessed we were to be here. And I was last here with the Duchess of Cambridge, and she said, well, what was it like working here? And I was sitting in Hut 6, exactly where I did sit when I was 18, when I first came here. And I said, well, I think in retrospect, what we did here was probably the most important thing that any of us did in the whole of our lives. And we were lucky. We were in the right place at the right time. We were able to do it, and we did it. And we're all proud of it.
Because there was a lot of German people and a lot of English people like me. We didn't want war at all.
No, of course not.
It was the politicians at the time declared war, and that was it.
Yeah, but in the end, I guess, you know, if you have a madman like Hitler, he needed to be stopped. Being German, personally, I'm really grateful for the way things ended, because I couldn't be here now. Well, maybe I would be here, but in a very different world, and in a world I wouldn't want to live.
We wouldn't be here, that's for sure. When we went to Germany, we met a chap who ran a wine business in Germany.
This is in the last 10 years or so.
And Barbara said to me that I must not mention the war. So I didn't.
Did you get away with it? Yes, but his daughter had also said the same. And because we were thinking, which one's going to mention it first? And then all of a sudden this man said, where was your father in German?
Yes.
Where was your father in the war? And I said, well, he was in the Luftwaffe.
Because Dad recognized Luftwaffe.
Of course.
He only spoke German, and I only spoke English, so we couldn't talk to each other.
Oh.
But it was funny, really, that he was up in Norway, and I was in the Mediterranean, so we were nowhere near
each other. Oh.
It was good fun.
Good. Oh, I'm so glad, you know, that this is possible now, you know,
yes.
After all this.
Yes.
Well, in fact, in 2 years' time, it'll be 50 years since we met our German friends, and we've been friends with them ever since. But we had a great time. We were wine tasting in the Moselle.
Oh, that's a very good place to talk about
it
things
was,
like
yes,
that.
It was, yes, excellent. So no inhibitions after that, no.
George Keller.
And what brings you to Bletchley Park today?
We came to visit some of the original World War II veterans that we've gotten to know here. I think this is my 5th visit to Bletchley Park.
So is it the human story that sort of intrigues you rather than the location and the work?
Well, I had a great career as a U.S. Navy cryptologist, and these people really started my career. and they're just absolutely great.
What inspired you into that career in the first place?
I got into it by accident. When I joined the Navy, I came in with a higher rank because I had a ham radio operator's license. And I expected to be a radio operator or a technician because I'd finished my schooling at that point, and I wound up in a cryptologic unit. And the rest is history. We have great reunions all over the country. We have a lot of fun. And at the reunions, I show my PowerPoint presentation of Bletchley Park and the people. I even did it at National Security Agency's Symposium on Cryptologic History. They had me come down there and do it. One of the people that was at that was a gentleman. We knew he was a World War II vet, because my wife and I are big on World War II vets. We have these honor flights back in the States where we take the World War II vets, put them on an airplane, fly them down to Washington, let them visit the World War II Memorial. So I said, oh, that's pretty good. Where were you? He says, Bletchley Park. I almost passed out. I couldn't believe it. He was here. He was an officer, and he was awarded an MBE. What a guy.
Yeah.
Selmer Norland, fine gentleman, just laid back. Oh, yeah, I got a MBE. Yeah, right. Yeah. Terrific guy.
Martin Bloomfield.
Ashley Bloomfield.
Abby Bloomfield.
Is it your first visit to Bletchley Park today?
I've been coming here for about 10 years.
So how come you come here so regularly?
We live quite local, so it's just a good place to visit.
What's the interest for you?
I guess it's the history of the place.
What do you find most exciting about Bletchley Park?
I quite like seeing what the workers did here.
You mean the code breaking?
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, I like learning about the history of World War II and what the people did in the war.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Has it been a worthwhile visit today?
It's been excellent. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I've been talking non-stop to various different people, a lot of veterans. In particular, two veterans I met. Both of them had heard of and remembered my grandfather, which was particularly exciting. Even though they weren't able to tell me very much information, I think because he was the sort of the manager, they only met him a few times. But it was just so thrilling that they actually knew him. To actually meet people that had worked with him was very special for me. It helps to sort of say, yes, he definitely was here, sort of thing. It's almost, more proof, so to speak. And the fact that people still alive today can remember him all those years ago is quite amazing, really.
Yeah. First of all, obviously, capturing the veteran stories and the first-hand histories is the most important thing. But we shouldn't forget the ones who aren't with us any longer. Someone else in the family taking an interest like you have and investigating and researching the background, that's going to become more important as we lose the veterans.
Absolutely, and it keeps the story alive. And also, I'm obviously trying to discover his story, which of course is very difficult to do because of course he signed the Official Secrets Act and he passed away in the 60s, and certainly nothing was ever talked about. But it's been particularly interesting for me because I came in June for the first time and I met Mike Chapman, one of the volunteers, and I had a photograph. My father had seen it when he was watching a documentary. The photograph flashed across the screen really briefly and then was taken off the screen, but my father saw a photograph with my grandfather in it, his father, which was amazing because he didn't even know of the existence of the photograph. And it's taken, we believe, in Blocky, in a room full of teleprinter operators, and he's standing there in the background. And one of the interesting things was I mentioned this to Mike, and this particular picture is one of the full-size floor-to-ceiling blown-up photographs in the chauffeur's hut. And Mike does a guided tour and mentions this photograph, and he always thought that this character, who is my grandfather, was just a visiting member from the MOD, and to find that it actually was an employee was very interesting to him. And of course, since then, I've obviously learnt more information, and he's also helped me to find more information, and it's brought his whole story alive.
Well, I'm glad you've had such a good day, and I wish you all the luck, and I hope you find everything out you possibly can.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
They classified, in Hut 3, the three military and the three air section, classified the messages into four grades. First grade was, this is absolutely top priority, has to go out within sort of 2 or 3 hours. Second grade was, it needs to go out to whoever, really, before the end of the shift. Third grade was, we'll do it when we can, and it may go out in hard copy form. The fourth grade, and it's the German for nonsense, rubbish.
Quatsch.
Yes, that's it. Mm. And that's what they called it here.
Right.
It was nonsense. And you can just imagine a bunch of academics and military officers saying, we'll call it. You said it completely different to how I did.
You'll be glad I recorded this.
I'm glad you studied in Germany.
So it was all...
Come on, you don't normally get stage fright.
I don't. I didn't realise you were recording me. So it was quite a complex process for how they actually produced that intelligence. And we talk a lot about the decoding, which is where Hut 3 is fantastic. Because for the first time, we're really talking about now how the messages came in and how they went through the different sections, the advisors, through to producing the intelligence before then going out. Anyway, we're going to have a wander around the back.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Because we were saying about the pools failing on the bomb.
Oh, right, yes.
So the bomb team have just had a part of the bomb that's failed.
The pools on the clutch mechanism has just failed, so we've actually got a temporary one in. Currently having one hardened, that will be fitted this week. But Eric mentioned to me one of the things that failed on the bomb in the war was the same part, the pools.
Yes.
It's information like this is priceless.
Don't ask me to repair it, because I wouldn't know how to do that.
But I just think it's lovely that,
yes,
you know,
a part that's failed,
something goes wrong and you're here. Yeah, that happened to when I was doing it.
Yeah.
We've had another gentleman in, Paddy.
Paddy, yes, I spoke to him.
And he mentioned it to me as well.
Oh, did he?
He said, yes, he said,
yes.
The pools did fail.
Yes.
So it's something we've not
heard
of.
Of course they do. I mean, nothing is infallible. All things fail occasionally, don't they?
Did you and Paddy serve together?
No.
No,
I didn't really actually know him. I knew a Paddy, but I don't think that was the one. But then it's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, these years hence, they're going to look different. Same with that, I'm looking different, you know.
Oh, I imagine you look as young handsome as you did when you were married 6 years
ago.
Look,
I'm not saying I don't look handsome, I'm just saying I'm not as young.
You celebrated your 90th birthday recently.
I did indeed.
And your 60th wedding anniversary.
I did indeed. And how do you remember all that?
Because you told me so.
Oh, did I? And you remembered it?
Yes.
Good for
congratulations
you.
Congratulations
on
both.
And you've got a good memory, I haven't.
Well, I think you've got a fantastic memory, Eric.
No.
If you can walk in there and go, yep, that's the bit that used to go wrong. And it's stories like that that keeps the history alive, as far as I'm concerned.
Good.
So thank you very much.
Okay.
I hope you've had a good day.
Thank you very much. Yes, we have indeed. Yes, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.